The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Why is light so far?
Like, it sounds so simple.
They had no idea.
But now the data speaks.
I find this not only refreshing, but at some level astounding.
Nature.
Welcome back to the Nature Podcast. This week we find out about two neutron stars that have made waves in the physics world, and take lessons from the past as we explore the future of work. I'm Adam Levy.
And I'm Benjamin Thompson, here on my very first podcast hosting duty. This is the Nature Podcast for October the 17th, 2017. You may have heard the announcement on Monday that a new gravitational wave signal has been spotted. The ripples in space-time came from neutron stars spiraling into each other and eventually merging. This was the first time merging neutron stars had been observed, but that was just one of many firsts that this event heralded. Adam has been finding out more.
Gravitational waves have defined the career of astrophysicist Samaya Nisanki.
I basically started working on gravitational waves since I was an undergrad.
And for quite some time, many of her colleagues saw this as something of an unusual choice.
Senior, well-meaning folk took me aside and said, you know, Samaya, you seem pretty smart. Maybe you want to spend your time doing something with real observations about the universe. Maybe it will happen one day, but, you know, in your lifetime. So, yes.
Fortunately for Samaya, this pessimism was misplaced. In late 2015, gravitational waves were spotted for the first time by the LIGO detectors in America. That observation came from two black holes collapsing together, something that had never been seen before. But researchers like Samaya expected that other never-seen phenomena should also be detected. For example, the collision of two neutron stars, while less massive than black holes, could still be picked up. In August this year, Samaya was at a conference in Amsterdam. She remembers that there was still a fair bit of skepticism that a neutron star merger would be seen anytime soon.
Over lunch, I was talking to the LIGO India head, and, you know, he mentioned to me, well, Samaya, in 2019, 2020, I don't think, you know, we will have observed a binary neutron star with gravitational waves. And I have to say, I did pause, but I said, okay, I will take my second scientific bet in my life and say that actually I disagree, and I think we're going to see a binary neutron star by 2020. And literally half an hour later, this email came into my inbox saying, wow, you know, there's some amazing observation that was seen by LIGO Hanford, and it looks like a binary neutron star.
Samaya and other gravitational wave researchers around the world sprung into action. Within a few hours, comparisons between the signals from LIGO and its Italian counterpart Virgo had pinpointed a small area of the sky that the signal must have come from, just 30 square degrees.
And so this was really, really amazing. You know, firstly, because, for instance, the very, very strong gravitational wave event that we saw 2 years ago, the first binary black hole observation, had a sky error of 590 square degrees. So when we're talking about 30 square degrees, of course, you know, that totally changes the game for electromagnetic follow-up.
Electromagnetic follow-up. In other words, this provided the opportunity to take normal telescopes and hunt the sky for the light from the neutron star merger. Word was quickly put out to astronomers around the world. Astronomers like Ryan Foley, who uses the SWOPE telescope in Chile. Ryan had been waiting for the chance to hunt down the light emitted by gravitational wave events. But even when he got this alert, he'd have to wait a little bit longer.
To make any kind of astronomical observations, we had to wait for the sun to set. During that time, which was about 10 hours, we were just preparing so that everything was as efficient as possible, and so that when the sun did set, all we had to do was execute.
But even once the sun set in Chile, Ryan's team didn't have long to put their plan into action.
So there was just a short window of time where we had to get everything done, and then after that you'd have to wait until the next night. You know, this is something that we'd been preparing for a while, but it's always different to do a fire drill and then when, you know, the house is actually on fire. It was sort of a frantic but calm scenario. And somehow it all came together perfectly right at the right time.
It was an astronomer in Ryan's team who first spotted the telltale bright dot, indicating the galaxy where the neutron stars had merged. They put out word to other telescopes around the world, and soon every possible observation was being made of the events. So this was the first neutron star merger ever observed. But it was also the first event to be detected both with gravitational waves and with light, all the way from radio waves through to gamma rays. This event teaches us a wealth of things about our universe, where heavier elements come from, as well as one origin of the gamma ray bursts that have long puzzled astronomers. When the detection was announced on Monday, a whole host of papers were published in several journals, including Nature. But as well as the results detailed in these studies, the fact that we can now chase the light from gravitational wave events opens up a whole new era of observing our universe.
So I think it's a game changer in the sense that we have now opened up all our senses.
For millennia, humankind has been looking at the universe. And then just with the advance of LIGO, have we been able to hear the universe. And with this event, it's the first time where we've been able to see and hear the same thing at the same time. And so it's really a new outlook on the universe. And it's incredibly exciting.
That was Ryan Foley, who's based at the University of California, Santa Cruz. You also heard from Samaya Nisanki, who's at Radboud University in the Netherlands and is also a member of the Virgo Collaboration. To find out more about the event, which involved hundreds of researchers, make sure to read Nature's in-depth news story. That's at nature.com/news.
Next up, we've got Sharmini Bundell with this week's research highlights.
Ammonia is normally pretty bad for cells. It's a byproduct of the breakdown of amino acids and is usually excreted from the body after being turned into urea by the liver. Tumours, however, often have trouble getting rid of their waste ammonia, since many of them don't have the blood vessels needed to tap into the excretory system. Unfortunately, rather than letting the build-up of toxic ammonia get them down, some cancer cells have been found to be metabolising it instead. Researchers discovered that breast cancer cells can use ammonia to build new amino acids, successfully recycling the toxic waste into a food source. Consume more on that over at Science. A study of ancient coal deposits has shown that dinosaur poo had a big impact on prehistoric ecosystems. It looks like the evolution of large herbivores, like sauropod dinosaurs, changed the number of vital nutrients that were available to prehistoric plants. Coal laid down in the Cretaceous period, after the appearance of giant long-necked plant eaters, contains more key nutrients than coal from before large herbivores arrived. The nutrients were also more widely distributed, presumably because of wandering dinosaurs defecating far away from where they ate. That's all very well for Cretaceous creatures, but it might also suggest that the ongoing disappearance of large herbivores such as elephants could impoverish modern ecosystems. Digest that further in Nature, Ecology and Evolution.
This week, Nature's running a special on the future of work. To find out what this future might actually entail, Benjamin spoke to two researchers, looking at it from rather different angles.
Could a robot take your job? As technology advances, there's a risk that many people will be left out of work. It's easy to imagine the impact that self-driving vans and trucks will have on many vocations, but not only that. Back in February, Nature reported on an AI that was able to identify skin cancers at least as well as a dermatologist. But this isn't the first time the nature of work has been turned on its head. Britain's Industrial Revolution began in the second half of the 18th century and saw a massive shift in manufacturing practices and the way that labour forces were structured. According to Bob Allen, a historian at New York University, Abu Dhabi, the earliest people affected were spinners, workers who took raw cotton or wool fibres and span them into yarn.
There were many, many people employed in the pre-industrial economy as spinners because the hand processes with a spinning wheel were very inefficient.
The introduction of machines like the spinning jenny, invented by James Hargreaves in 1764, revolutionized the process of making cotton, allowing operators to produce multiple spindles of thread at once. This automation quickly eliminated the hand spinning of cotton, making many women unemployed and raising poverty rates. Needless to say, this made many workers very unhappy.
They rioted. They burnt down mills and destroyed the equipment. So, the workers resorted to direct action to try to stop mechanization.
The government at the time didn't take too kindly to attempts to stop the march of progress and suppress its opposition with force. Despite these conflicts, though, output levels soared.
Productivity shot up by factors of 20, 30, 40 times. But what happened was, so there were new jobs created in the cotton spinning industry in Britain as it was mechanized. But the number of new jobs that was created was much less than the number of jobs that were lost. And in addition, it's important to recognize that the ramifications and the job losses were not confined just to Britain. Machines greatly increased productivity, so British production rose and exports rose, but they caused widespread unemployment across Asia and the Middle East.
But is widespread automation-related unemployment something the world needs to brace itself for in the 21st century? Sabine Howard from the Bristol Robotics Laboratory isn't so sure.
The main challenge really comes from the fact that we're trying to predict the future, right? Some say that robots and AI are going to increase productivity and as a result we'll have more jobs overall. Some say that they'll replace 40% of jobs over time. And I think the key here is that we don't know and we need better data.
According to Sabine, even understanding the impacts of robots today is a challenge.
If you look at the data from the International Federation of Robots, they tell us that from 2010 to 2015, 60,000 robots in the automotive sector created something like 230,000 jobs. So an overall net positive impact. But another study from MIT, also looking at data, showed that one robot displaced 5.6 workers in the automotive sector in the U.S. in a local community. So what you can see is that even though there is clearly for people an impact at a local level, there might be an overall positive impact. And I think we're at the stage where we don't know what way that will go. And what we're missing is figuring out how to explain this well, because it's very dramatic to say someone has lost their job, and it's very important to figure out how to help them, how to make sure they're retrained, and to make sure that they can live a good life.
And training, or retraining, is clearly important. In the UK, a recent government document predicts that within 20 years, 90% of all jobs will require some elements of digital skills. As we learned from Bob, not everyone in the 18th century benefited from automation. So what needs to be addressed to make sure that everyone does in the future?
We realize there is a concern. There is a concern by the public that the benefits won't be shared. And it's not just monetary benefits. It's also access to these technologies that could make your work and lives better. And profoundly what this is a societal question, right? How do you make sure that everyone has access to the same level of education, has access to the technology, and how do you make sure that the wealth is not concentrated by just a few people? And I'm hoping that as a society we can answer these questions. To a certain extent, they have nothing to do with technology, and they're the same discussions we've been having for a very long time.
That was Sabine Howitz there. You also heard from Bob Allen, whose comment article can be found at nature.com/news.
Time now for this week's News Chat, and Nature's senior reporter Lizzie Gibney joins us in the studio. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Adam.
Now, first up this week, it's looking somewhat likely that a gene therapy might be approved in America.
That's right. So this is a bunch of advisors to the Food and Drug Administration. So this is not an actual approval yet, but it's some advisors who have given their guidance saying that this therapy should be approved. So it's likely that the FDA might follow suit.
And what is this therapy actually hoping to do?
So it's hoping to treat a form of hereditary blindness. So that's for people who have got two mutated copies of this one particular gene. And that gene stops your eye's ability to respond to light and eventually leads to destruction of some photoreceptors in your retina.
And presumably, if they've got to this stage, it's already been tested to some extent in humans?
Absolutely. So this follows a controlled trial of 31 people. And they gave them this treatment, and then they looked at their ability to navigate around a specialised obstacle course. And they found that over the course of the year, which was as long as the study lasted, there was significant improvement in their ability to go around that course.
This wouldn't be the first gene therapy approved by the FDA, though, would it?
No, that's right. So there's another gene therapy that was approved in August. And that was a case of taking out people's immune cells and re-engineering them and putting them back into the body. This kind of gene therapy, though, is what everybody classically thought of as gene therapy. So this is the first example of the therapy actually replacing or compensating for a gene that's missing in that person.
But gene therapy is a type of therapy that there's been some, I suppose, hesitance about historically.
People have been thinking about gene therapy for decades, and I guess for about 20 years it's struggled because of a few failures to get going, a few real problems, like there's a death of a young patient once in a clinical trial, so it really struggled to get out the blocks. But now in the last few years we've seen a couple of much more promising trials exactly in this area. And investors are starting to come back. A lot of young researchers are starting to get involved in the field again. So it does seem like it may be on the brink of resurgence.
And there's been a lot of talk of gene editing human embryos recently. This, unlike that, would not mean anything could be passed on to future generations.
Absolutely not, no. So this is not an edit to the germline, so it's not something to be passed on. It's just in that individual's genes. And actually, that's one of the issues, is they don't yet know how long the effect will last. So the way it works is a virus actually kind of forces the gene into the person's cells, but they don't know how long they will continue to express that gene that they are otherwise missing.
Let's move on to our second story, which I feel has a special significance for Lizzie, because only a couple of weeks ago in our 500th show special, you recounted your podcast piece about AlphaGo, the computer that mastered Go. Well, now they're back and they've done something even more impressive.
Yes, it's technically called AlphaGo Zero. It's basically a super duper version of AlphaGo. So this is a version which is better than all of the previous ones. So they now have the original beat the European champion, then the next one beat a world expert. And then they've got the most recent one, which is called AlphaGo Master, which beat the world champion and is definitely the very best out there until now. This one's called AlphaGo Zero, and it's not just interesting for Go aficionados. It's interesting for people in AI, because what they've done is stripped out the human data element of it. So how all the previous versions learned was they got a kickstart by studying expert games, and then they went from there to improve by playing themselves. This version just starts completely from scratch. So it starts off with random games and plays itself. And over time, and also a lot more quickly than previous versions, it got up to the level, it passed through all the levels of all the previous versions until now it is the very best out there.
So it's the very best out there just by teaching itself how to play this board game.
Exactly. So what is also quite interesting about this is it's a much simpler program. So this is able to learn a lot faster and get to being a lot better more quickly.
So they've mastered Go now several times. Are they going to carry on making new pieces of software which are better and better and better at
playing
Go?
That's actually a question I need to go back to them on, because I don't know yet if this is the end of the line for Go. It's such a good way of testing out their programs. And actually, because what they're doing is obviously not just trying to get amazing at Go. They've done that now. If that's what they were trying to do, they'd have stopped a while ago. What they're trying to do is work towards the most general artificial intelligence they can. And there are lots of different paths to doing that. But this particular idea is that they're employing in AlphaGo Zero is to get rid of human input, because if we try to apply artificial intelligence in the real world, there may be many situations where we don't have reams of big data to learn from, or the data that we have isn't perhaps quite suitable. And in that case, a computer that can just learn from scratch by playing itself in a way is going to be much more useful.
What kind of things are we actually talking about? Presumably when we say the real world, we don't mean other board games.
No. These would be things like problems like protein folding to figure out how a particular structure will fold. There are other problems as well where you're either working towards an optimum, so for instance in terms of energy consumption, or where you're looking for new materials, say, and there are so many different possible options out there, which, like the Go board, there are so many combinations that it'd be impossible just to brute force attack it and try and work your way through all of them, but instead you generate this intelligent way of searching through all of those possible options.
Has this piece of software that's learned to play Go taught Go players any new tactics? Has it come up with anything new itself?
It has, actually. So the way in which it learned, because all the time it was playing against itself, and it started off like a beginner, like both sides were a beginner. So they played in a very human beginner way, very naively. And then it quite quickly, after just I think about 3 days, it got up to the kind of master expert level. And then after 40 days, it's this superhuman level. And some of the strategies are, it's recreated ones which humans have spent thousands of years coming up with. So on one hand, it's quite nice to say that we haven't been playing Go completely wrong the whole time, and there are some really great strategies there. But on the other hand, it's also in some ways opened up options, because Go is a very traditional game. There are lots of proverbs and learned knowledge from the great masters that go into how people play. And actually, AlphaGo and the more recent version, AlphaGo Zero, have shown that these are not strategies that you have to stick to, that you can break the mold a little bit. And it's come up with some whole new plays that people hadn't thought of before. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, really.
Lizzie, thanks a lot for joining us. For more on those two news stories, head to nature.com/news.
So that's it for this week. Thanks for listening, team. We're back again next week with more great stories from the world of science. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're at Nature Podcast. And if you've enjoyed the show, be sure to tell a friend or leave us some stars in the relevant place. I'm Benjamin Thompson.
And I'm Adam Levy. See you next time.
Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus. The key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.